This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, and get the one talk. Nōia e Māori and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We would like to acknowledge that Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Hopefully you had an amazing Easter weekend with your family and friends as we kickstart off a brand new week with stories from across the Pacific. We head to Papua New Guinea, where they are one of the worst affected countries with tuberculosis. So there's a significant amount of money that will be pumped into the country for treatments to reduce these numbers. And how will a national development plan boost quality of life for the people of Tonga? And we all love a feel-good story, so stay tuned on a Samoan speech that wowed crowds at the recent high school's Polyfest in Aotearoa. More on those stories shortly. Wherever you're tuning in from, we appreciate it. Remember, once our stories are online, you can find them by simply typing Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine. We're across Facebook and Instagram at ABC Pacific, and we do welcome your feedback. But I'm your host, Aggie DeBolt, and this is Pacific Beat. Now, you may remember the story from a couple of years ago about a seasonal worker from Vanuatu who was charged with murdering a man in Australia. Police alleged the Niwa Vanuatu man, John Yalu, killed a 66-year-old man by sawing off his leg at a riverfront park in Innisfail in North Queensland. Well, 2 years on, the court case has barely progressed, and Mr. Yalu still hasn't entered a plea. So to find out why, we're joined by ABC reporter Christopher Tester, who's been following the case in far north Queensland. With that, I say good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Oh, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Very much a bizarre alleged incident, of course, involving John Yalu, and this made headlines back in February 2022. Can you maybe just break down a little bit about what he was actually accused of?
Yeah, as you said, it was an incident where he essentially sawed off a man's leg, allegedly using a circular saw at a riverfront park in Innisfail. But what made the case particularly unusual was that police at the time were alleging that there was an agreement between the two for him to do this. And of course, that 66-year-old man died at the scene. And Mr. Yalu was charged with murder. So it was described in court the other day as not a whodunit case. It's not necessarily a mystery, and that Mr. Yalu, the court heard, admits to sawing off the leg. But where the case will turn is on whether he knew that doing that was likely to cause this gentleman's death. And as you say, 2 years on, the case hasn't reached a resolution yet.
Again, and that's it, still awaiting trial 2 years on, but the Supreme Court judge in Cairns is concerned about how it's tracking through the court. So what is the actual latest?
Well, in Queensland, a case will start in the magistrate's court, regardless of how serious the charge is, and it will go to what's called a committal hearing, where the defence will have a chance to test the evidence. And that bit has happened. That's happened in Innisfail, and the case has now made its way up to the Supreme Court. But where it's been held up is at the what's called the arraignment process, when the accused person enters a plea of whether they're guilty or not guilty. And there have been about three or four attempts now to have Mr. Yalu arraigned, where he's been brought into the court in Cairns, but the arraignment hasn't been able to go ahead. And we've heard that his lawyer has concerns about whether he's mentally fit to plead, that perhaps he might be affected by a mental health condition. And ordinarily, you would be assessed and evidence would be presented to the court as to whether you are or you're not fit to plead. But the unusual case is that Mr. Yalu is represented by a solicitor from Victoria rather than Queensland. And that seems to have led to some delays. There are, of course, you know, it's not necessarily easy to get an appointment with the kind of psychological or psychiatric expert who could make this decision as to whether you're fit to plead. And the delays have caused some frustration. Justice James Henry acknowledged this week that he found it a bit puzzling that a man accused of such a serious charge, with a few complications in his case, not notably that it's the allegations are unusual, but also that he requires a Bislama interpreter to follow the court proceedings, that you would have a lawyer from another state whom he hasn't actually met in person. So the solicitor, Michael Rodriguez, has only communicated with Mr. Yalu, the court heard, by phone or by video link. He's never actually travelled to far north Queensland to meet him in person.
Yeah, Chris, which is probably what most people would consider very unusual. Or is it unusual to have a lawyer from so far away?
It's not completely unheard of. People do often choose, for whatever reason, to have a lawyer represent them from interstate if they perhaps specialise in a particular area. I've tried to find out exactly how this situation arose, and I haven't had any luck yet. But the judge noted that there's nothing he can do about that, that it wasn't a comment on Mr. Rodriguez's competency as a lawyer, but just the challenges that you would have in representing someone in this kind of sensitive case. What is more common is for a solicitor to be based locally, to meet regularly with the accused person, you know, usually to be based in the same town or region, and then they would brief a barrister for trial. And often the barristers will come from, you know, in Queensland's case, they'll probably be based in Brisbane, and those are highly specialised lawyers. So the judge questioned, in this case, essentially whether it was suitable for Mr. Yalu to have an interstate lawyer in such a complex case.
Again, so they are waiting whether or not his lawyer would continue to be representing him, or are they looking towards probably getting another person?
No, at this stage, it looks like Mr. Rodriguez will continue to represent him. There was no indication at a hearing on Thursday as to whether that would change. What will happen next in the case, though, is that this week, Mr. Yalu will be assessed by a forensic psychologist. From there, that psychologist will put together a report, which usually takes 3 to 4 weeks. What we do know, though, is that at the next hearing of this case in May, which will be yet another arraignment attempt, Justice James Henry has said either Mr. Yalu will be required to plead guilty or not guilty, or there will need to be an application for the case to go to the mental health court. So he's essentially said there have been enough delays. At the next hearing in early May, the case must move on one way or the other.
All right. If you've just tuned in to Pacific Beat, we are speaking to ABC reporter Christopher Tester about a seasonal worker from Vanuatu who was charged with murdering a man here in Australia. I do want to know, though, what do we know about Mr. Yalu, and how did he actually seem in court last week?
We know that he's from Vanuatu, as you said, and he was working on banana farms. Innisfail is about an hour south of Cairns by road, and a very strong banana growing region. So I'm not sure exactly how long Mr. Yalu had been there harvesting bananas, but for instance, you could see from his social media profile that he had quite some experience working in that agricultural sphere. He's being held at the Lotus Glen Prison, which is in far north Queensland, and the court heard that one of Mr. Rodriguez, his solicitor's concerns, is that there isn't a whole lot of mental health treatment that he's able to get there. So there is a mental health nurse, but other than that, it's really difficult for him to get mental health treatment. The lawyer raising this as a concern for what might happen with his case. In terms of how he presented, he didn't say very much during the hearing. There was a Bislama interpreter who translated the important parts of the hearing for him, and other than to acknowledge that he understood what was being said, we haven't heard much yet about Mr. Yalu's version of events or how he sees the case against him.
Chris, with the case being, of course, you know, since 2 years ago, any terms of support from family and friends that have shown up in regards for Mr. Yalu?
Thursday morning's hearing was very procedural and very brief, so there wasn't anyone there at that case. But, you know, usually when these things get to trial, and we've heard that probably the earliest case scenario would be that a trial will be heard in the second half of this year, that's when you usually start to see more supporters attending court cases.
Okay, so really, what's next steps there for the case then?
Yeah, as I said, he'll have an assessment this week. From there, it'll go to another hearing in May where we'll find out definitively what's going to happen, whether he will plead not guilty and take us to trial, or whether perhaps there will be an application for the case to be heard in the mental health court. The mental health court, if that is the path that the Mr. Yalu and his lawyer want to go down, is not quite as open as the Supreme Court. Those hearings are heard privately. But yeah, if he chooses to plead not guilty, the matter will be set down for a trial date. So we could find a trial date next month. And as I said, it's likely to be later in this year.
But are you aware, if he does plead guilty, what could the sentencing be?
Then it would proceed to sentence. That would be much quicker. I couldn't tell you what sort of sentence he's facing, because that would come down to any deals as to what he pleads guilty to that could be reached with prosecution, and any factors in sentencing. As a case as unusual as this, it's not one that I've come across before, where the allegations essentially centre on an agreement between the accused and the deceased.
Absolutely. Well, Christopher, thank you so much for joining us this morning and giving us a bit of insight into what is happening. I'm sure we will keep up to date with you later on as the trial nears.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. That is ABC reporter Christopher Tester joining us here on Pacific Beat. Pacific Beat. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Agito Bol. Well, there's hope that tuberculosis cases could be reduced in the Pacific after an increase in funding. The Australian government has committed $17 million to help develop more effective treatments for TB and help ensure they reach the communities across the globe who need them. The disease is caused by a bacteria and mostly affects the lungs, but can also cause problems in other areas of the body. But it can be treated with certain antibiotics. Now, the Chief Executive Officer of the Aid Organisation Results International, Nageya Chorley, joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Aggie. How are you going?
I am good. Thank you very much, Nageya, for joining us this morning. Look, as we get into this, the worst affected country in the Pacific region is PNG. What's the actual situation there regarding TB at the moment?
Yeah, look, that's a really good point. There's Asia Pacific is actually home to 60% of the global TB burden. So TB is very much on our doorstep when it comes to Australia. We do see TB right across the Pacific. We see it particularly in the Solomons, Kiribati, Fiji, Marshall Islands. But as you say, PNG is of particular concern. So PNG is what's known as a high TB burden country. We see, you know, up to 30,000 cases a year. But what I think is especially concerning when it comes to Papua New Guinea is there's very high rates of what's called multi-drug resistant TB. So this means effectively a form of TB that isn't responsive to antibiotics. And we're seeing it especially concentrated on islands like Daru in the Western Province. So, you know, this is worrying because it simply means that traditional antibiotics don't work. And it has broader health security implications, not just for PNG, but for the region and globally.
Yeah, gosh, that is such a high number, 60%, considering 30,000 cases. Does it mean then that things are getting worse, or have they gotten worse over the past year or so?
Look, what happened as a result of COVID-19, as you can imagine, is, you know, the entire world's focus shifted to COVID, and in many ways it was a really lost opportunity because COVID-19, just like tuberculosis, is an airborne disease. And what we could have done when people presented with a cough, with a tight chest, is we could have tested for both tuberculosis and COVID-19 simultaneously, particularly in high TB burden countries. We didn't do that. We just tested for COVID, except in India. They got it right. They tested for both. But what it meant was a lot of tuberculosis cases were missed. And as a result, not surprisingly, we saw a spike in cases in the latter years of the COVID pandemic. So we saw an increase in incident rates, but also really worryingly, for the first time in decades, we saw TB deaths go up right around the world. We've done a bit of a review of World Health Organization data in our region. And interestingly, TB deaths in PNG went down 32% between 2022 and 2021. As always, you've got to question, you know, the data and hope that for any country, but hope that we're looking at the right numbers. But certainly it looks like deaths may have gone down in PNG, which is hopeful. But the other really interesting step forward that's happened in PNG in the last 12 months is there's a wonderful doctor there, a woman called Dr. Joyce Sook, who herself had pulmonary TB, you know, years ago. And she has started what's called a TB parliamentary friendship group. So she's got 17 parliamentarians from right across PNG. And she started this caucus group really looking at how they can effectively tackle TB right across the country, including drug-resistant TB in places like Daru. So there's, I think, growing political commitment to addressing it, which is wonderful. And certainly Australia has been a long-term partner of the PNG government and doing a lot, I think, to support the government in their efforts to tackle TB. But, you know, they have been hit. They essentially had a triple crisis of you know, they've got particularly high HIV rates, they had high COVID rates, and they had high TB rates. So it was certainly, it has been a health system really struggling.
Thank you for clarifying that. Before we get into, of course, what the government from Australia have committed to in regards to funding, are there any sort of pockets in the country where you believe the situation is particularly bad?
Probably Daru is the main concern for a lot of people, just because of the drug resistance TB. So, you know, if we think about antimicrobial resistance as essentially what would it mean for us to live, you know, pre-penicillin days, and that's what it means not to respond to antibiotics. So, I mean, tuberculosis, we should care about tuberculosis because over 1 million people die every year, a disease that's preventable and treatable. So, you know, there's a strong ethical argument to care and invest in ending tuberculosis. But there's also a broader argument just around the need to end it because it has significant implications when it comes to antimicrobial resistance. So, and this is, as I say, it's a health security threat that has implications for the world, not just for PNG.
Yeah, and you did speak about the World Health Organization being, you know, concerned about the situation there in PNG. And I know they're calling for an urgent increase in investment to tackle TB. Now, the Australian government, they've committed funding. What's your reaction to that? Do you believe it's going to be enough to help fight TB in PNG?
Look, the Australian government has historically been a really strong partner when it comes to the global effort to end TB. And we've had really strong bipartisan support. So there's actually a little bit like PNG, we have an Australian TB caucus here as well. It's headed by Warren Entsch and also Kate Thwaites, who are both incredible advocates for ending TB. And the Australian government, again, this is Coalition and Labor, have invested heavily in the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB and malaria. So over the last 20 years, we've contributed a total of $1 billion, which is obviously a pretty significant investment. So, look, I think we've done quite a bit, but what we would say at Results International is that we need to do more. So, as I say, this is a disease that's both preventable and treatable. The fact that over 1 million people die every year, but they tend to be, you know, people that live in poor communities, people that live on the margins. We don't talk about it enough. We don't focus on it enough. And we certainly don't invest in it enough. So there needs to be more. And we all need to step up. I think donor countries around the world need to step up. But just going back to your point, Aggie, around this latest investment. So we certainly welcome the news. This is part of a $620 million four-year Partnership for a Healthy Region initiative that was announced by the government last year. But certainly this year at our World TB Day breakfast, they announced the $17 million for TB Alliance. And this is money that I think is very well invested. So the TB Alliance are doing really important work in creating shorter treatments for TB, in creating new treatments, especially for drug-resistance TB, which, as I say, is a significant concern for everybody. But the other part of the funding, which I think is especially exciting, is they're setting up a peer-to-peer learning centre in Manila. And what they're doing that for is so that doctors and healthcare professionals from different parts of the region, including the Pacific, can talk and share information about how to best treat TB, including drug resistance TB. So that sharing of knowledge and information and capacity building support across countries is so crucial, especially when you think about the Pacific, of course, where we've got really disparate populations spread across multiple islands. So, you know, this, as I say, this is money really well invested. For every dollar invested in TB, you get a $40 return. So even just when it comes to health investments more generally, investing in TB is a fantastic investment to make.
Wow. If you've just tuned in, we're speaking to Chief Executive Officer of the aid organisation Results International, Nagaya Chorley, on recent funding from the Australian government towards PNG's fight against tuberculosis. I must say, are there other countries in the region, though, that you feel are also badly affected? I know you did mention a couple at the beginning.
Yeah, there was an interesting study released last year in the medical publication PubMed, which looked at World Health Organization data for the Pacific over the last 20 years. And what they, I guess, picked up was that overall there's been a slight increase both in incident rates but also in deaths. But in particular, we've seen TB increase in Fiji, Kiribati and the Marshall Islands, whereas we've seen TB decrease in New Caledonia, Samoa and Tonga. So what that really shows is that, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done. Some of the risk factors, particularly in the Pacific, are things like diabetes. So if someone has diabetes, they're at higher risk of developing tuberculosis. If someone smokes, if they're malnourished. It's really interesting. Of course, we don't necessarily think of people being malnourished in the Pacific, but there are pockets, of course, in places like the Solomons, even in Kiribati, where we do see higher rates of malnutrition. And the other big risk factor is alcohol. So, you know, they're all factors that go on around the world, but we also see it again in pockets of the Pacific. So it does mean that people are more susceptible. And even where you've got condensed living, and this is why we see such high rates in parts of Asia where you've got really significant large populations. But as we know, there are parts even in Kiribati where there is really condensed living because of there just isn't enough space, then we do tend to see higher outbreaks of TB. And it's what we would describe as a disease of poverty. So where you see conditions of poverty, you tend to see TB take off.
Nageya, as we wrap up, you spoke about diabetes, smokes, being malnourished, and even alcohol was, contributing factors towards, contracting TB. But what would your message be for our listeners, specifically there in PNG, that they need to know and really keeping themselves safe from TB?
Oh, I think I'd be nervous to give advice to people in PNG because I've been battling TB for years, and so many, particularly frontline healthcare workers, are doing an incredible job at tackling TB in their local community. But I think what I'd say more broadly is just that the one lesson we learned from COVID-19 is when we have the right skills, when we bring the right minds together, when we bring the right level of investment together from around the world, that anything is possible. And you think about what we achieved with COVID-19, developing a new vaccine in under 2 years. I think the same argument can be made for tuberculosis. It's completely unjust that, over a million people die every year from this disease. And not just in PNG, but in other parts of the world, it's really important that we do all we can to partner with governments in their efforts to really end TB once and for all. The global community have signed up to end TB by 2030. That's just 6 years away, so we've certainly got work to do.
Definitely. But I'm sure you're up for the challenge, and I do appreciate the work that you guys do there in the Pacific region. So thank you again for joining us this morning, Nageya.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Aggie.
No worries. That is Chief Executive Officer of the aid organisation Results International, Nageya Chorley, here on Pacific Beat.
Join Sosse Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Samoa, where the Prime Minister, Fiamea Naomi Mataafa, became Samoa's first female Prime Minister when she won office in 2021. But the trailblazing politician has been awarded an honorary law doctorate by the National University of Samoa in recognition for her dedication and leadership in empowering women and advancing education in Samoa. She received the award at a ceremony in the capital, Apia, where she praised the university for its work in building the country's future leaders.
The purpose of education is to turn mirrors into windows. Samoa is very fortunate to have its own national university that will continue to educate our young, to equip them with the relevant skills, values, and knowledge to succeed in life. Not to look good in mirrors or to look out just for themselves, but to look out through windows or to look out for others, to have a long, clear view, to prosper extended families.
And that's Samoa's Prime Minister, Fiamea Naomi Mataafa.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, they were one of the last Pacific nations to get internet coverage. And after years of high prices for mobile data in Papua New Guinea, consumers are now finally getting lower prices. Researchers say this is thanks to the arrival of a third competitor in the telecommunications sector. I spoke to Dr. Amanda Watson, researcher with the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University, on her latest findings. Before we get to the rates, can we just talk about the actual cost of phones itself? Are they quite expensive?
So many people in Papua New Guinea would still not have a mobile telephone. There'd be people who live in places with no mobile network coverage. And so there's still some people without mobile telephones. And then of the people who have mobile telephones, quite a lot of them would not yet be using the internet. So obviously this research that we're talking about today focuses on mobile internet prices, and therefore it's only applicable to the people in Papua New Guinea who are using the internet through mobile telephones.
Why has it become so expensive there in PNG?
So Papua New Guinea was one of the last countries in the world to get mobile network coverage in rural areas where most of the people live, and it's one of the least urbanized countries in the world. So there are many people living in rural and remote areas that didn't have access to any kind of telephone until the Digicel company started to use its new license from July 1, 2007, and rolled out mobile network coverage to rural and some quite remote parts of the country. So Papua New Guinea, compared to many countries, came to mobile network coverage quite late, from about 2012. Prices compared to other countries around the world, and including compared to other countries in the Pacific, such as Fiji and Samoa, Papua New Guinea's prices for mobile internet have been very high.
So you've actually been monitoring those internet prices since 2020. Do you mind sharing just some of those findings?
Yes, so we've been collecting data every Monday since the first Monday in 2020. And for quite some time, there was no change. And certainly in our update in April 2022, we were once again reporting that there was no change. But since then, there's been a big change, which is that there's been a new mobile network operator commence in Papua New Guinea. They began to launch their services in late April 2022. Of course, we can't be completely sure what's causing the prices to go down, but it does seem that the entrance of a new company into Papua New Guinea's mobile space might be the cause.
So if there is no competition within that industry, we are assuming that that is the cause of the high rates there. Is that correct?
Yes, well, what happens with competition in the private industry sector is that the companies are competing for customers. And so if you're walking down a street and one store has a sign saying $4 coffees and the other one says $3 coffees, well, it's fairly obvious which store you'll go to. I mean, you may eventually decide the $4 coffees taste better, but you're most likely to try the $3 coffees first. So the same applies to just about any product. And in this case, we are seeing increased competition. And it seems that this new company, which is a Fiji-based company, it's come into Papua New Guinea, and it seems like it's perhaps shaken things up a bit.
Okay. So price-wise, which is what I'm sure most of our listeners would want to know this morning there in PNG, what can they expect in terms of cheaper prices?
Yeah. So if we take as an example the best offering that Telecom had in 2020, the Papua New Guinean company called Telecom was offering 0.6 toya per megabyte for a lot of its data plans, and their best offering was 0.5 toya per megabyte. So half a toya for a megabyte was the absolute best price that a Telecom customer could get, whereas now their prices are 0.3, 0.2, even for the larger data bundles, down as low as 0.1 toya per megabyte. So it really is quite a significant drop, and indeed across on the Digicel side as well, prices have been dropping. And of course, Vodafone, as we've discussed, is a new entrant, and especially when compared to, say, the kind of prices that we were seeing in the year 2020 and 2021.
Effectively, this really would be a welcome development, right, for users there in PNG, like small businesses, those who often may not be able to afford internet prices. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, yes. I think that many people and indeed businesses are quite pleased and welcoming the reduction in mobile internet prices, because it's not just for individuals, but there are people trying to run small businesses and even medium-sized businesses and large businesses would have mobile telephone calls and mobile data as a substantial part of their cost base, just trying to coordinate staff, movements of freight and logistics and so on. So I think that, yeah, many people would be welcoming the reduction in prices, but it is also worth remembering that some people do really struggle to afford mobile internet. I mean, I have friends in Papua New Guinea who just really couldn't even be expected to, you know, to have internet access week to week. I mean, it's for some people, it's still quite prohibitive. But nonetheless, the prices are going down, and that's what we've found in our research. And I'm sure that is a welcome development for many people across Papua New Guinea.
And with that, are we hoping that the prices of internet or mobile data will continue to decrease?
Yes, indeed. We are expecting the prices to keep decreasing. And I think the competition, because there is that competition between the providers, they'll keep trying to move in different ways to try and get a competitive advantage and attract those users. So I think that kind of thing will continue to happen in the coming months. I'm not sure how long that will go on for, but certainly that's what we're anticipating.
And that is Dr. Amanda Watson, researcher with the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University.
Hi, I'm Seyuli Salamasino von Reiki, and I invite you to come with me to explore how our Pacific cultures have evolved with the changing times in a new show, Culture Compass. You'll meet people who are passionate about keeping traditions alive, passing them down to the next generation while adapting old ways to the present. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. While most countries have a strategic development plan, which outlines what a nation will do to boost development for its citizens, in Fiji, the government has been running nationwide consultations to get public and industry input for a national development plan. But just how good is a country's development plan? Well, Donga is finding out by commissioning a European university to test whether its priorities are value for money. So joining us this morning is the Speaker of Donga's Legislative Assembly, Lord Whakawhānau of that. Malo e lau maalie, Lord Whakawhānau.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us this morning. As we get into this report, how important was it for Donga to go down this path and carry out a cost-benefit analysis on its policies?
I think it's worth noting that this is actually an independent study, although it was done in partnership with our Ministry of Finance, a Tongan think tank, the Royal Oceania Institute, and the Copenhagen Consensus Centre. It is the first type of study that's been conducted, as far as we know, in the Pacific, and we're very proud to have this document on hand to help decision makers analyze what gets the best value for money in terms of the government's interventions.
Lord Whakawhānau, what were the big results then from this report that you hope Donga's government and even the policymakers will take away from it?
So what this cost-benefit analysis study did was apply a traffic light towards government's interventions in the existing budget, guided by GPAs, or what we know as government priority agendas. The scoring goes from poor to good to excellent. And I think the outcome was largely good because there were no poor outcomes in terms of government's priority agendas.
Yeah, before we get into some of those, I mean, how will this report help the government decide, you know, like where to spend its limited resources?
To quote what the Prime Minister says, he tends to think that there are various menus that the government can pick from. And this is just one of those menus to help inform them make a better decision in terms of value for money. And we would like to think that this report be very influential in terms of decision making for our parliamentarians when the new budget comes in next month.
Yeah, now I did have a look through that report, and correct me if I'm wrong, I saw maybe about 14 interventions in this report. Can you maybe elaborate on even what an actual intervention is?
So one of the key interventions that's in this report is reducing corruption through e-procurement of government services. So this means that with a small investment into e-procurement, the government could save a large amount of its procurement every year from then on. This is being seen as a very high cost-benefit ratio. So it scored very highly on the report. And in terms of the outcome for the people, it means economic, social, environmental outcomes that far exceed how much investment the government put in at the start. So there's that in terms of the efficiency of running of the government. Then there's the installation of early warning systems. As you're aware, the Pacific Islands, Tonga is a small island developing state, highly vulnerable to natural disasters and impacts from around the world. So an early warning system would help the population and also government infrastructure become more resilient.
And talking about that, because yes, we remember the recent Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai volcanic eruption, right? That affected, of course, many families and homes. Again, anything in the report that speaks to how the government can actually mitigate and maybe recover from those natural disasters like this?
Well, early warning systems scored excellent, which means that we shouldn't reduce the budget allocated for early warning systems. As far as excellent scoring means, it means that that should be a priority. It should be in the next budget, and allocations should be added to it, not reduced from it.
And there was a mention of even building a seawall. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, in terms of sea level rising, this is investment in the future. And it also means that we're increasing our resiliency and protecting both private and public infrastructure from damage. And it ensures that we can recover faster. And in terms of the sea level rising, that's a new reality that we have to live with. And building seawalls is definitely something that's on all small islands' agendas.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Joining us this morning on Pacific Beat is Speaker of Tonga's Legislative Assembly, Lord Whakawhanua, on a report that is hoping to aid in Tonga's quality of living. And as I say, and I talk about the quality of living, I know that poverty is a significant issue. We know that there's high cost of utilities that can really put pressure on families. Does the report have any proposals to help reduce poverty or even increase economic opportunities?
It does. The report gave a good score to investment in the growing financial services sector. It gave an excellent score to product diversification. So that facilitates trade, which means reducing middlemen and ensuring that the economic, social, environmental benefits are translated to those on the ground, like farmers in Tonga.
Want to switch to, of course, even other measures in the development plan, like the second undersea cable. That actually got a bit of a low rating as being not value for money. So then should the government then drop such policies?
And in terms of studies such as this, what it does is it has a very short time frame to measure how much value, social, economic, and environmental you get out of it. So it skews away from large infrastructure projects that have long periods where you amortize the debt or the finance, and the return is realized over a much longer period. So infrastructure projects such as the undersea cable, such as other projects of that scale, like bridges, airports, ports, are very important and will be prioritized by the government. But in terms of where that money can be realized much sooner in terms of the socioeconomic benefit, there are other priorities that the report recommends that could realize a much quicker benefit. So it's not to say that these infrastructures are not as important. It's just that the benefits will be realised over a much longer period of time.
Which then the opposite of that would be the reducing of corruption through e-procurement, as you said earlier. Should this then be a government priority?
Of course. The benefits that we will get from adopting such policy and investing in e-procurement is estimated around 10% of total government procurement. So over 2 or 3 years, we'll be able to recover the initial cost, and that benefit would then be able to be reallocated to other priorities.
Now, Lord Whakawhanua, while I have you on the line, I hope you don't mind that we shift our focus on news that has sort of been making headlines. Over the past month, we understand that there's been a bit of a standoff between the King and the Prime Minister, and I know that's captured the Pacific attention. I mean, how far away do you think we're getting to a resolution on this situation?
I think that the so-called standoff that the Pacific is looking at is the relationship between the Prime Minister and His Majesty the King. And in terms of that conversation progressing, Prime Minister recently returned from the Niues, which is the furthest most outpost where His Majesty is currently residing. And the conversations there, although confidential, seem to be quite positive. And I can't speak more to that other than you should probably ask the Prime Minister himself.
Absolutely. We are aiming to have possibly him on the show. Lord Whakawhanua, we do really appreciate your time this morning and being able to give us a bit of insight into this new report. And we really do hope better things for our people there back in the kingdom.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and have a happy Monday Easter.
Absolutely. You too. Again, that is a Speaker of Tonga's Legislative Assembly. That is Lord Whakawhanua here on Pacific Beat.
O lo ingo o Beth Sharon Mattox o o malo utina na banana in New Zealand ai lo utama asafana i America o lo utubuanga e o mai i uelese engelani sikotilani masi.
Wow. That is a speech from Year 11 student Beth Sharon Mattox. It went viral with more than 300,000 views and climbing of her speaking in Samoan. Well, Mattox, who is of Welsh, German and Scottish heritage, wowed the crowds at this year's ASB Schools Polyfest, placing fourth overall in the Samoan speech competition. Now, the 13-year-old shared with me how she's been overwhelmed with support since delivering that speech on why being bilingual or multilingual will benefit her and her future. Bisharon, how has it been since sharing your speech in the Samoan language at Polyfest? What's been the response?
It's been very positive, very encouraging, a bit overwhelming, but since it's like a lot, so many people, it's just getting used to the reactions and recognition I just get now. Most of the time, I'm just living life.
You know, growing up around the Pacific culture, I mean, you attend Tangaroa College itself, which we know is majority of the students there are Pacific, right? I mean, did you know much about the culture, like Tongan, Samoans, Cook Islands, Niueans?
Oh yes, because the church that I go to, there's a lot of Samoan people, and every so often at church, we have a cultural night. So some of the girls do their items. And I think that was the first time where I spoke Samoan. I did two Bible verses memorized in Samoan, as well as an introduction as to what I was going to be saying in Samoan. So I guess that would be like a step.
Because of that, it looks like you're surrounded by it because of church, which is beautiful. What's it been like when you were thinking, I'm going to try and learn the language?
Well, when it comes down to being taught Samoan, although it is very much a community thing, there was one specific woman at church that would help me with the pronunciation. She and my dad go way back with their family back in the day, that sort of thing. It was my main two teachers at school, but it was also her throughout more of my lifetime.
And what else have you actually learned about the Samoan culture, like the food that they eat?
The food is a statement at our church. Yeah, the reason why we call it a feed is because when you go there, they are going to feed you. No such thing as being full.
Is there, because even of your culture, correct me if I'm wrong, you are Welsh, German and Scottish. Any similarities from the Pacific cultures to even maybe your own?
Well, when it comes down to food, food is in every culture. We love food. That's just normal. One thing is both Welsh and Scottish people have kilts, which I would say Kilts are like a more significant and warmer version, say like in a year lover lover.
Mm.
The only thing, however, with the only difference I would say with a kilt is each clan has a different pattern for their kilt, which makes them, it makes them special to their clan. And now Scottish people don't have villages, they don't have tribes, but they do have clans, which is very similar.
Can you just sort of take us through what that was like, having to put that speech together for the Polyfest?
Well, I knew what I wanted to say. The main thing, because once I was given the topic, I wrote down what I wanted to say in English. And then after that, the main task was getting it translated and then learning how to pronounce the words and memorizing it.
And when you were on that stage, how were you? Did you feel nervous when you gave the speech?
Sort of. Because when I was speaking the speech, usually I was just getting a bit annoyed at myself because I had to keep on looking down at the cue cards because I was annoyed that I hadn't like fully memorized it, even though I had it in my mind.
Now that you've sort of learned that, and you have been doing Samoan classes right at Tangaroa College, moving forward, would you like to just continue to utilize the Samoan language in like an everyday type of thing, or was this just specifically for the speech?
Well, I usually do speak Samoan in everyday times because it's part of, like, the community that they speak it, so I just speak it back, especially with, like, hellos, thank you, please. It's just the basics, really, but I do speak it on an everyday basis.
I take great encouragement from you being able to embrace another culture, which brings me to this, Beth Sharon. You know, New Zealand-born Samoans, as you know, some of themselves, Pacific community, find it hard to learn their own language. What would be your encouragement for them?
Don't be discouraged by comparing yourself to others, because you are unique. And you know what? The same actually goes for me as well, because I don't know the languages of my culture. Like, I know English. I'm very fluent in that, which is my predominant ethnicity. I know a bit of German, but I'm not the greatest. I'm not very fluent. And I know nearly zero Welsh or Scottish. When you are learning another language, it's to be able to communicate with somebody. That's one of the main reasons why I speak Samoan, is to be able to communicate with the people in my community.
Well, you know the lady I was talking about at church? I always call her Auntie Soretta, because she's family, even if she's not by blood. So I just say, Fa'afite, Auntie Soretta.
And that, of course, is Beth Sharon Mattox from Tangaroa College at this year's ASB Polyfest in Aotearoa. A very amazing young woman.
Pacific Beat.
Well, that really does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat. Remember, if you want to find our stories, you simply need to type Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine. And remember, we are across Facebook and Instagram at ABC Pacific. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. As always, I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. Well, stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because news is next. Then coming up after that, it's the boys, Michael Chow and Jacob McGuire with Nisha Daly. Until then, mālo abito. O tua awhātu, I'm Aggie Dubow, and you've been tuning into Pacific Beat.